From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, the Pritzker administration giving a cool reception to the Chicago Bears stadium plan, and a proposal to rebuild two state prisons could leave one town out in the cold. We'll talk about that and more coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus, former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, we have Dan Petrella, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Dan, it's good to have you back with us once again.
Good to be with you guys.
So, Dan, we talked about this on the show last week. The Bears, they have their stadium plan, a lakefront stadium near Soldier Field, which they're wanting to move out of. For those not following it closely, give us kind of the quick overview of what this plan entails.
Sure. It entails essentially building a new stadium on top of what is now, I believe, called the Waldron Parking Deck, which is south of Soldier Field along the lakefront. And eventually the long-term full sticker price plan calls for demolishing most of the existing structure of Soldier Field, leaving the historic colonnades and horseshoe in place and sort of restoring those, and then creating a lot of new open space and parkland around there on the lakefront, which they say would actually increase open space on the lakefront by about 20%. It's a plan that would cost about $3.2 billion to build the stadium, plus another $325 million, I believe it is, in what they say are the infrastructure improvements that are necessary to get the stadium open. But then they're also looking for another $1.2 billion in infrastructure costs that would finalize or make the whole vision a reality. All the pretty pictures would involve that full sticker price between stadium and infrastructure that adds up to about $4.7 billion, not including any of the additional interest that would go along with all the borrowing that would need to be done to do it.
And you wrote about the fact that although the Bears have talked about they want to see some state money, they're making a pitch for that, some state help for this. The numbers aren't quite clear on just how much taxpayers could wind up paying for this, not just at the start, but like you said, down the road as the interest continues to accrue.
That's right, because the way they're proposing the state financing portion of this, which they have sold as a $900 million avenue of new borrowing, would balloon to about, the best estimate we have is about $4.8 billion over 40 years that they want to take to repay it. It would involve refinancing about $400 million in existing debt for $430 million actually in existing debt for previous projects at Soldier Field and at Guaranteed Rate Field where the White Sox play. They want to borrow another $160 million to set up this liquidity fund that would protect the city from shortfalls in the hotel tax revenue that pays for the stadium bonds. Currently, the structure is that if those bonds fall short, if that tax revenue falls short of what's needed to pay the yearly amount for the bonds, the city's share of state income tax revenue gets docked. And so they want to set up this extra fund, which would be money that would be borrowed and we would be paying interest on, to sort of shield the city from a little bit of that risk.
Well, I know some elected officials have come out, at least given some, maybe some enthusiastic support in some cases, maybe tepid support in others, but it's not going to go anywhere unless the Pritzker administration's on board. I think that's pretty clear. Some high-level members of the cabinet met, or I should say of the governor's administration, met with the Bears this past week, and what did you find out about that meeting?
Yes, it was his chief of staff, Ann Caprara, and Andy Menar, the deputy governor, who's in charge of all things financial for the Pritzker administration. And they met with virtually with Kevin Warren, the president of the Bears, and Karen Murphy, who is their executive vice president, who's in charge of the stadium situation for them. And afterwards, the governor's office issued a statement saying that the proposal that's on the table right now is a non-starter. Which is interesting. The governor had previously described aspects of the proposal as non-starters, but they kind of came out and broadened it to say this whole thing is a non-starter right now. Pritzker has been saying since, 2 years ago or so, when maybe it was even longer ago than that now, when rumblings about the Bears potentially buying Arlington Park started happening, that the state, he doesn't believe, should be in the business of subsidizing stadiums for private sports teams. And it does not appear that there has been anything that has changed his stance on that issue.
Charlie, I know where you stand on this. You were pretty clear that you didn't think this was going to happen, at least under the plan that has been put out there at this time. Nothing you heard this week, I'm sure, changed your mind.
No, as a matter of fact, the response from the governor's office through his spokesperson was that this is a non-starter. And he was pretty clear. He said, in order to subsidize a brand new stadium for a privately owned sports team, the governor would need to see a demonstrable and tangible benefit to the taxpayers of Illinois. Then, kind of as a sop, the office remains open to conversations with the Bears, lawmakers, and other stakeholders, with the understanding that responsible fiscal stewardship of taxpayer dollars remains the foremost priority. And this notion that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but this notion of having the finance authority kind of refinance the existing debt and borrow by selling 40-year bonds, I'm not aware of any bonds that the state or a state entity has issued in the past for 40 years. The maximum has always been 30. Some of them have been even less. The additional financing costs plus the interest, the proponents of this are saying, well, it's not paid by Chicago residents. It's from the hotel tax. And Chicago residents don't stay in the hotels by and large, but this would be out-of-towners. This would be people from out of state. But that may be true, but it overlooks the fact that when the existing bonds are paid off, that hotel tax will be available to be spent by the city and the county and the state on other pressing needs rather than to continue to pay the financing costs on this, from my perspective, this ugly looking monstrosity on Lake Michigan.
Yeah, as of right now, that revenue from the hotel tax first would go to pay back the city for the money that it has lost from its share of state income taxes to subsidizing the shortfalls in the hotel tax. And then once that debt is paid off, it currently is slated to go to the McCormick Place Convention Center. But obviously, you know, if the state decides that it has better places to spend the money than on McCormick Place, it could rededicate those revenues to any number of things. I think part of the issue here is that the teams view this revenue stream sort of as their revenue stream, which really, you know, it has been. This was all created back in the late 80s to keep the White Sox from decamping to Florida by Jim Thompson and Mike Madigan at the time. You read all about that in my colleague Ray Long's book about Mike Madigan. But, you know, I don't think people at the state necessarily see it that way. You know, this is a revenue stream that, like Charlie said, could be dedicated to other things. And, you know, it was sort of fascinating to see Brandon Johnson, a mayor who campaigned as this progressive champion, try to really spin this stadium deal as you know, a piece of his progressive agenda, which I think raised a lot of eyebrows, you know, across the political spectrum, but even from some of his close allies, both in Springfield and on the city council.
Well, Dan, Charlie mentioned that he doesn't like the look of this, and I think it's more of where this is located, a very scenic lakefront with a lot of historic architecture around it, the museums, and this very modern-looking dome coming in. It just looks out of place. Have you heard much of that? Has there been much feedback as regarding, like, what the stadium itself would do for that lakefront area?
You know, this is where we at the Tribune really miss our former architecture critic, Blair Kamen, who I'm sure would have a lot of very insightful things to say about the design of the stadium itself. You know, I think there's, from my perspective, there's only so much you can do with a football stadium. It needs to have certain, you know, attributes to be able to meet its need. But, you know, there is this group, Friends of the Park, who was successful in blocking George Lucas from building a museum of narrative arts on the lakefront. I guess a decade or so ago now that was. And so, you know, there's going to be opposition to a new large structure on the lakefront for sure. And I think another question that the Bears have not answered is what the real advantage of doing this in the city versus on the property that they own in Arlington Heights would be. You know, one of their original cases was they needed the revenue streams from non-football events and things like that. And if they're going to be operating out of a stadium that would be owned by the city of Chicago or the Chicago Park District, they're going to have to share some of that revenue, one would think, with the Park District. So that part to me is also a bit perplexing.
You know, and I always think about the Bears playing, and of course you'd see the scenic look of the lake, open air stadium in Soldier Field. You know, just kind of signified Chicago. To me, a dome, it doesn't really matter where you're playing at it. You could put that dome just about any place because the scene around it is going to, you know, look pretty much the same. Charlie, one of the things that we have, and you've been around for this discussion with the Bears for many years, including the one that took place about 20, 25 years ago, when they did the renovations to Soldier Field. But nobody comes out in the beginning and says, yes, we should build a new stadium and I'm all for it. But sometimes these things do get worked out. Do you see some wiggle room here that maybe Pritzker's leaving or some others are leaving to try to work some deal out on this?
No.
Pretty straight and to the point.
That might be the shortest answer. Yeah,
everybody has said that. And part of the reason, and I think Representative Kelly Cassidy, who's a Chicago Democrat, was quoted, I believe maybe in Crayons, is saying that the Bears' ask is unconscionable when we can't fully fund domestic violence shelters or sexual assault services or even fully fund our state facilities. It's not a world where we should be subsidizing somebody who's got plenty of money of their own. And I think that would be the general sentiment of people in the General Assembly. I don't see any support for this. And I think it wasn't Speaker Welch who said if we put it on the board, it would fail miserably. Think back on it. What was it? Maybe a month or so ago, the Kansas City Chiefs asked in a public referendum for money to build a new stadium for the Royals and to refurbish the Chiefs stadium. And it was overwhelmingly rejected. And this is a football team that's had, I think it'd be fair to say, a bit more success than the Bears of late. They've won, what, three of the last five Super Bowls? And I think the last Bears Super Bowl win, I want to say, was like in 1985. And the Bears, Warren says, oh, we got to do it right away. We got to get it through in the spring because time is money. And if we don't get the money now, it'll cost us more in the future and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, as you might have gathered from my sort of chortle there, I do kind of agree with Charlie. You know, I think if some kind of proposal gets out of Springfield, it's, I would think, going to be something vastly different than what the Bears have put on the table here from the outset. And I think the other question politically is whether Brandon Johnson, as mayor of Chicago, who has other things that he needs and wants from state government, is really going to spend, you know, political capital trying to push for this, or whether, you know, he wants to expend that on trying to get more money for Chicago public schools or more money from the state to help with the migrant situation, you know, homelessness, which, you know, he had this referendum measure on the ballot here in Chicago back in March that failed, that was supposed to produce more revenue for services for the homeless. So there's any number of things that the city could be asking for Springfield that I think would fit a lot better with his agenda and possibly get more support from lawmakers than subsidizing a stadium for the Bears.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and the Chicago Tribune's Dan Petrella. Well, the Pritzker administration has a plan to rebuild two state prisons, Stateville near Joliet and the Logan Correctional Center, a women's prison at Lincoln. But apparently the prison at Lincoln would be constructed, according to the latest plan from the Department of Corrections, near the Stateville site, meaning a lot of jobs locally in Logan County would be leaving. And Charlie, this is a difficult one. You can make arguments on both sides. I understand the reasoning to move this prison to a more northerly location, but you also can empathize with the Lincoln officials because those folks, you know, they've relied on those jobs for a long time.
Yeah, and it's the department filed, as required by law, a proposal with the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, responding to why they wanted to make this move. And one of the things that they pointed out was that the Logan is basically outmoded, outdated, and requires all kinds of money to bring it up to speed. They say, and I'm quoting from their their filing with CAGFA, nearly 1,000 of Logan's current housing unit beds were built more than 90 years ago for mental health population. Most of the buildings at Logan were built nearly a century ago. They're not supportive of a rehabilitative environment, and they complicate the overall delivery of required services. And the facility is fueled by a coal-fired plant that dates back to 1930. So they have something like $116 million in deferred maintenance, and they're arguing that that money would be better spent in constructing a new facility on available land at Stateville, which is in Crest Hill. I would call it a suburb of Joliet, as somebody who grew up in Joliet before Crest Hill existed. And they also point out that there are jobs will be available for the people who would be displaced at a number of other correctional facilities in the area, and that nobody would be fired. But the report doesn't really get into what the impact would be on Lincoln, the community. Now, Lincoln has had some really hard times of late. If I'm not mistaken, Lincoln Christian University is going to have its final commencement in a few days. They're going out of business. Lincoln College is closed. The Developmental Center went out of business several years ago, and I think the buildings are just sitting there deteriorating. And so it's really a blow to the city of Lincoln. But I think the argument being made that the move closer to where the majority of the population would come from is probably wise. So we'll see how this plays out. This whole thing represents kind of a change in how we've looked at prisons. And I went back and looked at some of the records from the Department of Corrections. And 20 years ago, this is on June 30th of 2003, the total population, adult population, was 43,186. And now, last June, the total population was down to not quite 30,000. So there's been a drop of almost, I don't know, I can't do the math in my head, but like 15,000 in the space of 10 years. As a matter of fact, the population has been going down, oh, quite some time. The high was in 2013, that fiscal year, when we had almost 49,000 people on February 9th of 2013. And the most recent one, as of December 31st, the population was 29,828. So the numbers have really gone down, and it's, in my mind, it's a change in philosophy from punishment to rehabilitation. And that involves not locking people up and throwing a key away, but trying to provide them education, providing them drug treatment services, the kind of mental services, the kind of thing that will prepare them to be released to the outside. Now, I was around for this prison building spree that Jim Thompson initiated. When he took office, there were like 9,000 people in maybe a half a dozen prisons, and now we've got more than two dozen. And the more we built prisons, the more overcrowded they became because of this punitive notion of enhancing penalties for everything. And that's kind of changed. But it is tough on the communities that are going to lose the prison. And there's a lot of prisons that are not, that have a lot of extra bed space. And many of them are old. Lincoln is the Logan site is older than many of the newer ones. It's one of the oldest facilities in the system. But I'm pretty sure it makes a lot of sense in terms of what the Department of Correction is trying to do to move the facility up closer to the Chicago area.
Dan, what's your thoughts on that as well? I mean, you've covered some of these communities that that have prisons. You know how important it is for their economies.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's always sort of been the idea politically that it was sort of I don't want to say there was a bone that was thrown to downstate communities, but it was really seen as, you know, when decisions were made where to place these things, as sort of, an economic engine for the communities, the same way, state universities or other large state facilities can be. And I think it's just, like Charlie said, sort of a sign of the shifting thinking on criminal justice and how we meet that out. And, you know, it goes back even, you know, one of the few things that Democrats and Republicans could agree on during the Bruce Rauner era was some of these prison reform issues. And one of the things that even, and I'm sure before his time too, but the Rauner administration was working on was a plan to reduce prison population. So it's an idea that has had some bipartisan support in the past, but it does deal an economic blow to these communities that lose a large employer.
And also, we should mention that the governor was in nearby Bloomington Normal this week to announce a state-assisted expansion of the Rivian plant. That's expected to bring an additional 500 jobs. That's about what the amount of the workforce is at the Logan prison. So possibility maybe at least of some help in that area for that. Did want to save just a couple of minutes here to also mention, of course, things move fast in the legislature this time of the year, and an election-related measure got through pretty quickly. Supermajority Democrats behind it. The governor has already signed it into law. Now, this would have some non-binding questions on the fall ballot, and that includes things like, do people support civil penalties for candidates who attempt to interfere with election officials? Should the state add a 3% tax on those who make over $1 million a year? And also some health insurance plans, should they be required to cover in vitro fertilization and fertility treatments? But it also makes a substantive change, Charlie, to state election law. And the way I read this, it prohibits political parties from appointing a candidate for the general election if no member of that party filed nominating petitions for the primary. So what does that mean, and how does it impact elections?
Well, I think it was designed, and this is my speculation because I haven't talked to the principals, but it's been widely reported. The Democrats were concerned that Republicans were going to, the Republican Party leaders in the Metro East area were going to put a candidate on the ballot to challenge Representative Katie Stewart, who is a Democrat from Edwardsville. And their concern is that if we can block political parties for appointing someone to fill a vacancy in a nomination, and if we can successfully do that and keep the Republicans in Stewart's district from putting somebody up for the general election, we can save a heck of a lot of money on Stewart's campaign, because the Metro East obviously is in the St. Louis area, and the TV markets are a lot more expensive than they would be, say, in Bone Gap or somewhere. And so the idea was to pass this, and they did it just in incredible speed. This whole notion surfaced, I want to say, Thursday morning, and by Thursday in the House, and by Thursday evening, it had passed the Senate. The Senate concurred with the House amendments, and the governor signed it. But because of the way things work, the governor signed it, but before the signed document was delivered to the Index Division, which formally makes it effective, the Republicans were able to get a candidate and put that candidate on the ballot. So there will be a challenge. And they got hundreds of signatures within a matter of relatively few hours. But this notion, it's funny because the governor was asked about, what did he think about it? And he said, oh, he thinks this is an ethics reform because it'll stop having these backroom deals to fill vacancies. And I'm thinking to myself, one of the things that was kind of a trademark of Mike Madigan as the leader of the Democratic Party in the House, they would wait and see after the primary was over to see who the Republican candidates were. And if they saw a Republican candidate that they thought was going to be easy to take out, then they would put a Democrat on the fall ballot to go against him. And so that's not going to happen. And even if it doesn't, what would you say, make it easier for Stewart, the other issues that you mentioned, Sean, are ones that would be popular, I think, with voters, Democratic voters, and it's maybe a way to spur turnout. Mm-hmm. Sort of a lackluster Democrat might say, oh, I don't really care for Joe Biden. But on the other hand, I can go and vote for this referendum to put a 3-cent tax on millionaires. So I'm all for that. So I'm going to go and vote. And while I'm there, I might as well vote for Biden.
You know, putting those three questions on the ballot crowds out the ability for any citizen-driven referendum questions to be placed on the ballot. And there were some folks on the political right who were pushing this question on what they would refer to as quote-unquote parental rights. And so the legislature putting these three questions on the ballot sort of blocks that from happening. Unclear whether it was going to happen or not, but that, you know, something that could have driven turnout on the right.
All right. Well, let's go to our notes from the field. Dan, we will stay with you.
Yes. So there's sort of an interesting Springfield City collision in the political world today around the funeral of Chicago police officer Luis Huesca, who was shot while he was coming home from finishing duty last week. His funeral was on Monday, and State Comptroller Susana Mendoza sort of got in the middle of the situation where the family did not want Mayor Brandon Johnson, who has been critical of police in the past and during his political campaigns, to be at the son's funeral. And she went public with that on social media, and it became sort of a political sideshow that in some ways sort of overshadowed the funeral of this officer who died in the line of duty. And Brandon Johnson was asked about it at a press conference earlier this morning on Friday, and said that he decided not to go, not after speaking with Comptroller Mendoza, but actually speaking the morning of the services with the mother of the slain officer.
And Charlie.
Well, earlier this week, the Pritzkers, Governor J.B. and First Lady M.K., donated to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum a very momentous document signed by Abraham Lincoln. And this was a document, an order by Lincoln, signed on April 19th, 1861, ordering a naval blockade around all the ports spanning the South. And this was about a week after Fort Sumter started the war. And the document, Pritzker said it at the time at the museum, he said, "This document and the museum as a whole serves as a reminder of how far we've come as a nation. Despite our current divisions and challenges, more than 150 years after a terrible civil war, our nation perseveres. Yet we must constantly learn the lessons of our past and channel the courage and conviction of our greatest president." And the price wasn't revealed, but there was an online listing from Heritage Auctions saying that the document was sold for $471,000 last summer.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.